So it is our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign, and it is our 19th. That is hard to believe. 19 years we have been doing this campaign. So we've got a whole cavalcade of guests here in the studio. It's as full as we can get it, and of course, I will start off with my co-host for the past 19 years, Sherry Johnson, and let you introduce yourself, and then we'll kind of go around the room.
All right. Good morning. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Cliff. Good morning, listening audience. I'm Sherry Johnson. I'm the co-host and the director of field education in the Department of Social Work at Humboldt State University and the chair of the Humboldt County Domestic Violence Coordinating Council. And to my left,
Bill Damiano. I'm the chief probation officer for the County of Humboldt and the vice chair of the Humboldt County Domestic Violence Coordinating Council.
I'm Jennifer Eichstein.
And I am Maxwell Schnurr, and I'm the chair of the Communication Department, and I'm also the co-chair of the Sexual Assault Prevention Committee at Humboldt State.
And I am Taylor Breitzman, first-year head football coach at College of the Redwoods.
All righty. So a very diverse panel of guests. And, you know, you may be saying to yourself, okay, I understand everyone. Why is there a football coach in there? Well, I'll tell you why. That is because... You know, one of the topics that we looked at in this culture of aggression was the revelations that came out in the NFL with the Ray Rice incident, and of course, so many more that have come to light. And it has made the NFL kind of come to grips with an issue that's been around for a very, very long time and kind of been swept under the rug for a long time. And with today's attitudes that are finally starting to shift, glacially, they finally are, it looks like they've had to deal with it. And I would say probably their first dealings with it were a little weak, and they were called on it. A few missteps, and they've since moved forward with that. But I really wanted to have one of our local football coaches come in. We've got Taylor Breitzman, who is the coach at CR here in the studio. And I was just curious as to how these revelations have affected, I guess, football on the collegiate level.
Yeah, I mean, you look at everything that's been going on, you know, especially as of late with the Ray Rice situation and it's just real unfortunate because at the college level, you look at a lot of these students, athletes who look up to these role models, and you look up, and not even the collegiate level, you look at everything, from Pop Warner, 9, 8-year-old kids who look up to these athletes and everything they do. And when you see something like this with the situation with Ray Rice and Baltimore Ravens and a couple others that have surfaced as of late, you just... it's difficult in a sense because now you're looking at guys who look up to these guys so much and not, you know, at everything they do, and they see this and they, you know, they're looking like at each other going, wait a second, is this how you're supposed to act? Is this what is this the normal response to these problems? Is this how you go about your business? Is this how you make millions and millions of dollars? And so it was a difficult as a student athlete in college to look at these role models and see people these guys at these figures doing these negative deals that just come out, and so it's real unfortunate, and you hate to see it because there's so many people that look up to those guys.
Is there some is it addressed with your students? Did this come up? Have you talked about this specifically?
Well, one of our core values and just in general is just understanding, respecting women and understanding how, because we play such a... You look at the game of football in general, and you look at the aggressive nature of it and the violent nature of it. And it's so, so you look at just the natural game that we play and that we coach, and you got to be able to – so we be able to teach that and coach that aggressive nature. And that's what makes it real difficult is you're able to – you have to teach it. And that's how the game is supposed to be played, in a violent way. It makes it difficult. But what you got to do as a coach is understand – or that environment has to stay, and that has to remain on the field. And so what we've done is I think, a good job with our staff is been able to emphasize that stays on the field. And when you cross those lines, what happens, between the you know, the violent piece of the game stays right there. And if any, you know, we just try to minimize everything that can carry over and try to educate our guys the best we can, you know, that aggressive nature stays right there on the grass. And when we get off the field, we're back as a family and we're carrying our business as such.
One thing that you mentioned was education. And, of course, that's a big part of, you know, collegiate football is, you know, they're there not only to, you know, learn football and perhaps maybe someday by chance make it into the NFL, but they're also there also to get an education. And a good education is one thing that can, you know, help broaden a mind, help, you know, make it so people can see things in a much broader perspective than perhaps they may have grown up with. And one thing that you guys are doing at CR, which I think could become a model for the nation, I think it is fantastic, is something you're calling the Cap and Gown Program.
Yes.
And for full disclosure, my wife Amy also teaches at CR as part of this Cap and Gown program. But it's an interesting thing because you've had a real problem. You've been recruiting students from all over the country. Very talented kids, they get in and fail out of school after a semester or after a year. And you have had to, you're pretty much have nothing but freshmen constantly on the team. That's not good for a football team, and that's certainly not good for these kids. So explain the concept of the Cap and Gown program.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's exactly right. It's all about that retention phase of a college football team. Now, junior college is unique in that regard because you only get student athletes for a year or a semester, even two at the most, you know. And so that education part is what our program is built on, because it really doesn't matter about the X and O's if you can't handle your business in the school and in the classroom. So this Cap and Gown program is something we sat down with and came up with a plan, because last year we lost 15 players to academic reasons. And it just can't happen. You know, it just takes your football team and crushes it. You know, whatever you know, all the work you've done because of an academic issue with a player. And we had 15 of them last year. So when I got the head coaching position here, we sat around and tried to figure out a way we can minimize the drops from the classroom. And so we came up with a program we call it Cap and Gown, where we can teach these student athletes coming in from all sorts of backgrounds and everywhere from local to, you know, we got guys from Florida on this team from all sorts of different backgrounds and histories and schools, and bring them in and put them in a program where it teaches them to be a student athlete and teaches them how to manage their time and forces them to learn how to study and things that maybe they're not accustomed to from where they came from. So this Cap and Gown program is a real unique deal that we're pushing hard, and we're already seeing results where we got a English section every night. It's 4 nights a week, hour and a half each session, where we have an English professor, a math professor, and then a general studies area where guys can just come in and just finish homework and do their homework. And what that does is, what we found is that it forces, you know, the hardest part, even in my experiences in college, have been starting homework. Mm-hmm. And if you can just learn how to start, you know, you see guys, even our student athletes now, the class goes to an hour and a half, but they'll stay later. I mean, right. they once they start, they get on a roll just like any. So it gives them another piece of it. It gives them an opportunity just to start. So it's every night. There's the math section where our guys that scored low at the placement test early on in the year can go and get their math and English bumped up so that they can then retake the test and pass it and get into college-level English and math, which then in turn will get them into transferable credits and then get them transferred out.
Right. The interesting thing about the program, which I think is really fantastic, is that they are not for credit. There is no grade, but it's mandatory. You know, yeah. If you're on the team, you have to go to these things. Essentially, it's basically learning how to do college. Because, you know, a lot of these kids, you know, they go from, you know, high school, where maybe they just got pushed along, because it happens, unfortunately, where people just get pushed along without an education, especially in various other parts of the country, and boom, they're in a college. and they're expected to, you know, to do it. And there's skills, you know, that often are not taught in high schools on how to do college. I mean, if you're taking maybe the AP stuff, you know, you're getting the college level stuff, college level education, getting to understand how college works. But those aren't the kids that you're that you're getting. You're not getting the AP kids. You're getting the ones that weren't on the AP track. And this is something I think I would love to see this expanded to, like, the whole school. Because I think this is something. There's a lot of kids who start, you know, at like CR, who, you know, maybe their parents said, "You're going to college."
Okay.
And they haven't a clue how it works.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, we look at it. You know, it's a huge recruiting tool as well, because you want to make sure, you know, you're sending your son off somewhere where he can be in a position to be successful. You know, sometimes, you know, and myself included, my biggest jump was from high school to when I went to junior college in Stockton, California at San Joaquin Delta College. And my biggest jump was from high school to junior college.
Sure.
Just because you're not you know, mommy and daddy aren't there anymore to get you to class and wake you up in the mornings, and all of a sudden you're off on your own, and, well, I have a lot of free time, and then there's that option, do I go to class or not? And not before, where it was you're forced out the door or dropped off, you know. So it's just, yeah, absolutely right. It's just it's teaching them how to go to college, and I think we're doing a good job. You see, 15 were dropped last year, and this year one, so we have already seen the results, and we're looking for a big spike of GPA as well. Will be the next way we measure it.
That's a huge success. I mean, you went from 15 last time to one,
right? And we had almost twice as many players this year come out.
Awesome.
So yeah, it's good to see the results way. But again, we want to see a spike in GPA and a couple other things. But it is, we've already seen the results, and it's been real positive.
And it just started.
I'm looking forward to those people hitting the workforce. You know, they start getting some practice on self-discipline and learning how to focus, and that'll help them succeed in work as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is fantastic. And, you know, it's, as we said, this is, you know, a good education is a good start to, you know, leading a good life, you know, where you're not going to be going down certain roads. Not a guarantee. I mean, there are plenty of really well-educated people who are still very abusive, do some terrible things, but you at least have that leg up. You do indeed. I think we're going to take a quick break. There are lots of different things for us to touch on this really broad topic of the culture of aggression. And so we're going to take a quick break and let our sponsor say a few words, and we'll be right back. You've got it on KHUM, 16 after 8. This is KHUM. It's our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. We've got our two-hour roundtable discussion. And I would like to remind folks that you are certainly welcome as a listener to participate in this conversation. This is a big community dialogue. And if you've got a question that you would like to ask any of the folks that we've got here in the studios, or something you'd like to mention, something you'd like us to take a look at and maybe explore a little bit deeper, the number 786-KHUM, that's 786-5486. You can also, if you would just like to email a question, you don't want your voice on the radio, that's fine, studio at KHUM.com, that will work as well. So we're dealing with the culture of aggression. It's a big topic, and during the break, we were kind of saying, well, let's touch on that, the culture of aggression. And I know you had something you wanted to say about that.
Hi, this is Jennifer. So I, when I think about culture, I'm thinking about the patterns or the ways that we do things in a group, among a shared group of people, that are sort of normalized, and that we don't actually even think about them very deeply. And usually things in culture are argued over, and they're fought over, and they're not necessarily agreed on, but there become some baseline agreements that communities have, and or ways of doing things that we just sort of take for granted. And I think that aggression is a very normalized, taken for granted part of what it means to be in the United States. And I'm being very specific about that, because we know that other cultures actually have very different norms about violence, or norms about harassment, norms about a lot of these kinds of issues. But in the United States, we have some deep norms about aggression and the acceptability of it. So it's just, we talk about boys will be boys. We talk about it's just the way kids act. We excuse aggression and violence and dehumanization because at its core, that's what it's about. And I think a lot of that is actually historical. Most people don't really like to go into history, but much about our culture, the dominant U.S. culture was actually grounded in a history of violence and a history of putting down different groups of people. And that's just carried forward. So I think about all the stuff that's going on right now, not just the Ray Rice case in terms of football, but I think many people have seen the video about the young woman who walks in New York City
and for 10 hours.
For 10 hours, yeah. And the amount of harassment she experiences. And I'm one of those unfortunate people that likes to read the comments that get put up on blogs.
Don't do that.
I know.
It's a trap. It's
a way to make your head explode. But one of the things, so there's been debate about, is it just because she's a white woman or a lighter skinned woman and she doesn't want, you know, it's that it's men of color who are saying things to her, which is not the case. And there's many, many examples and videos of women of color also being harassed and having the same kind of response. But yesterday I also saw a video that was from New Zealand. I don't know if any of you have seen this video. It's a duplicate of what was done in New York, where a woman walks around New Zealand for 10 hours. She has two interactions with people, one of whom is asking directions.
Wow.
And the point is that that's what you expect as a woman walking in New Zealand. You do not ever expect. She walks by construction sites. She walks by all these different kinds of places. And there's just nothing. It's a different expectation. And so I think that we have a tendency to naturalize this and to say, this is just what men do, or this is just the way it is, as if it's like that around the world. And it's just not. It's part of our culture. And the cool thing about culture is we can change it.
Absolutely.
It's not inbred in our bodies. It's not genetic. We can change this behavior. And one of the things that what Tyler was saying earlier that I wanted to pick up on is thinking about what it means to be a man. What is the normal cultural definition of normal male behavior? And how do we make that be part of that violence is not a part of that, and aggression towards other men or towards women or towards children or toward animals is just not part of that. And I think we need to have a good, deep conversation about that.
And I think that's, you know, so what we're doing. This is why this is brought up, and this is why we have this campaign every year. Yes, this is just our little small corner of a much broader country and even broader world. But, you know, talking about this, bringing stuff up, and bringing it part of the normal conversation is what helps. Maxwell.
You know, I think one of the words that comes to mind in this discussion is entitlement, the sense that you would be entitled to something. And I think it sort of threads through what Jennifer was just saying and some of the work that Tyler's doing. But I also imagine that it's part of the sort of conversations that happen with Bill's work fairly regularly, is the assumption that you would be entitled to sex. And one of the hardest things about educating about entitlement is that if you're entitled, you probably don't necessarily know that you're entitled. And it takes
what do you mean by entitlement? Just tell us.
Sure.
What
yeah. Unasked for, unearned benefits, something you might get just for being who you are, or sort of the assumption that, you know, sort of the boys will be boys idea spread through the culture, I would probably call entitlement. And so I think that's, you know, that's one of those real fertile places to talk about, which is when you ask young men to sort of say sort of what they assume their life and story is going to be like, I think that's a fertile place for conversation. And I really like just about anybody who's having some angle in that conversation. I think it's fruitful.
Well, I think really it also talks about the language that we use as a culture, you know, and we hear frequently things like war on drugs, war on women, war on this, that, and the other thing. War is violent. And that is really built into our culture, so it really kind of objectifies people, and I think that helps us, you know, be violent towards people when we don't see other people and their rights and as individuals. It also kind of sets people up to, you know, we just had a really great conference up at Humboldt State University on addiction and trauma and social change, and Dr. Gaber Mate had a lot of really good things to say, and Michael Yellowbird on culture and how our culture, Western culture, really kind of sets us up to suffer all kinds of different adverse consequences as children that then, you know, affect our behavior later on. Automatic reactions to people that are violent, that it's not a conscious thought, but it's something that's programmed into us from an early age just based on our experiences of being neglected, abused, or not getting our emotional needs met. Pretty important stuff. So as far as entitlement and the criminal justice population, certainly there's a different version of that or a different perspective on it. I know that I've worked with a lot of criminal offenders that basically see other people's property as their own, see no problem in just taking other people's things. Certainly a lot of violence, even though violence really makes up a pretty small proportion of the people that we work with in our caseloads, maybe 20% are violent crimes. But their interactions with other people are really about them trying to get their own needs met. And I think that, you know, going back to what Tyler was talking about in the programs in the college, it really kind of boils down to people becoming self-aware, becoming aware of their interactions with other people. I mean, we all have that responsibility in society, and that the way to change it is to work with one another, have conversation about those difficult topics, about decisions that we make, about behaviors that we exhibit around other people, and holding ourselves accountable with, you know, some compassion and understanding that we aren't necessarily choosing some of these things, that they're a result of a long history of factors that have shaped who we are and how we do things. Not necessarily our parents, maybe their parents and their parents' parents, or society.
Yeah, and oh, I just want to say, for the record, I believe your name is Taylor.
Taylor, yeah.
Taylor.
Sorry, Taylor.
Sorry.
Excuse me.
I'm sure. I get called Chris all the time. Cliff, thank you.
They have names for me, too. We won't mention them here.
I think, you know, the thread between Bill and Jennifer's comments is the sense that you learn violence, and I think that it also can be unlearned, which means, you know, really strategic and thoughtful ways to challenge those assumptions that you would get rights or privileges of entitlement. And, you know, we teach the Actions to End Sexualized Violence class up at Humboldt State, which is a one-unit seminar, and we've taught about, you know, something like 900 HSU graduates have spent a solid weekend working with a couple of thoughtful teachers and myself about developing the skills. And it's sincerely, we sort of start at negative 20, and you have to kind of learn what you're swimming in and then sort of develop some tactics and language to challenge rape culture, entitlement, and get those ideas in your head and then practice. I mean, again, anybody who's played a sport knows this, that the first time you try to do something, you're going to flub it. You know, it really does take structural educational support, I think, to challenge a lot of those ideas, which needs to be intentional and kind of really well thought out.
Yes, and an examination of the messages that are so consistent. And we have like these, you know, we have the big culture, and then we have the sort of the culture of our family and the culture of a sport and the alternative culture and all different kinds of ways in which we identify. But when the messages are really consistent about the other and the self, and that there are things that you can do to the other because they're not as valuable as the self. And so we have hierarchical ladder of value. And that's where the benefits and privileges really come in. And you see like a very small group of people really getting their needs met big time. And then lots and lots of people really, you know, struggling just to eke out a living for their children and themselves, working excessive amounts of hours. And the children who grew up in these situations, even with the intentional educational messages that need to sit side by side, it's really hard to unbind those messages, and it takes as long as it takes. And it's really a struggle for some kids who see other people getting their needs met in just an easy way. and that it's always a struggle for me and my family. And so it, they're almost, that aggression is like a response to get something. When it is unchecked and then solidified and supported, and by a belief system that actually allows that and encourages that, then we're doing horizontal hostility and we're fighting among ourselves, and that robs us of our power.
I think that I just want to say something, because I don't think it's what you're intending people to hear, knowing you as I do. But I think that we have to be careful that people, that aggression is not just the property of people who grew up with less resources.
Right.
That, in fact, you know, it's often my experience being a college professor and growing up working class. I didn't grow up in among a whole family of people who had higher education and stuff, was that the aggression of those who have more, those people who grew up not suffering, not needing, is often masked, and it's usually not criminalized in the way that the behavior of those who grow up with less is criminalized. And so I like to think of sort of, we talk about people growing up with sort of internalized oppression, so people who don't have much, learning to not believe they're capable or want much or that they're entitled to much. Yeah. But I think that for people who grow up with a lot, they often have internalized domination, is how I like to think of it, and internalize this sort of internalized sense that I should get what I want, and it's normal for me to get what I want, and you know, I can get it in all these different ways, and some of those ways are obviously problematic, and others are, again, normalized so that we don't see that they're problematic because they're accepted. And I think about all the shows that are on television. I'm not somebody who believes that television shapes our behavior. I'm not. I don't believe that. But I believe the context in which we exist is the problem. So, you know, it's not bad apples. It's sort of a bad barrel. And I think of the, you know, all the people who, you know, all the shows like the one, the bad with the guy with the bad hair. What's his name? The comb over.
Don't watch TV.
Donald Trump. That's who I'm trying to think of.
You know, so, I had a feeling you were talking about Donald.
Yeah. Donald Trump and all the, there's so many shows like The Bad Girls of X City,
right.
All these ones which are really about people acting badly and being valorized for it.
Yeah.
It's over and over and over everywhere you look. And it's that, I think, is actually increased. And I think part of that is increased with what they call reality television. Because it's not reality, but it's, you know, staged weird behavior, but it's valorized. And so more and more, I think people just feel that being incredibly rude, being demanding, being aggressive, being violent, all those things are just, they're okay. Everybody does it. We see it on TV. That's what they're
and
all
you
doing.
Get benefits.
On. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And it works.
They pay dividends.
And it works.
And
right.
It works. And that is one of the things that I find problematic, is that it does often work for people. Being a bully often works for people.
Of course.
Right? Because a lot of other people don't want to stand up to them and they don't want confrontation. And so, you know, I have watched many people who I consider bullies sort of be promoted up the ladder and because they're seen as, either people don't want to deal with them, and so somehow they get promoted, which, you know, you get them out of my
That's
hair by promoting
yeah.
them up, or yeah. people see their behavior somehow just being really forthright and really whatever, and it's like, well, no, actually,
it's
there's
business.
A, yeah,
right.
It's business. So, yeah. I think again, it comes back to that normalization and that mm-hmm. you know, it's just business as usual.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that you mentioned, and we've opened up so many things, and we're going to have to take a break, but we'll touch on a lot of these. One of the things that you talked about was you know, the otherization. You know, both of you actually did, mm-hmm. and you talked about the, you know, the rich otherizing everyone else, you know, that sense of entitlement and whatnot, and you know, that has traditionally been an easy gateway for you know, aggression towards whatever the other is. Now, one of the interesting things about that video that you mentioned early on, where this woman went through the streets of New York and was being harassed constantly, it was really a shocking video. is the fact that, at least in this country, there is an enormous otherization of women by men. Now, that's better than 50% of the population being otherized, which kind of is amazing and really does need to be addressed. So we can talk about that, and I know, Maxwell, you had some stuff you wanted to touch on. We got to take a very quick break, and we will continue our conversation on the culture of aggression. Again, if you've got something you want to add to the conversation, the number is 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486. You can also e-quest or just email with a question, studio@khum.com. And you've got it on KHUM, 36 minutes after 8 o'clock. We continue our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. We're dealing with the culture of aggression, and we do have a caller. Hey, you're on the air. Hello?
Hi,
yes.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Could the panel please comment on how cultural elements contribute to family violence, such as, quote-unquote, male honor codes, which exist in this country, including in the white community, such as, quote-unquote, the redneck culture. It's present in southern culture, both blue and white collar. And then how these threads get woven into the popular culture so that we have songs such as Hey Joe, et cetera. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for calling. We do appreciate that. All righty. So anyone want to take that question on?
I think that's a fantastic question and commentary. You know, I was listening to the K-Hum Halloween special, and I was thinking about how many Halloween songs were very rape culture. Mm-hmm. Sort of, I'm going to use my magic or trickery to get someone who's turned me down. I think, you know,
I put a spell on you.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could run through a long list of them. And I think that the invitation, the story that we swim in, all those examples that you point to, the honor codes, the stories about different communities and sort of that they're different or sort of treat people in unequal ways, I think is tied to that idea that we swim in the stories handed to us by the previous generation, and those as sort of normal and acceptable and expected. And those threads, I think, are in some ways fruitful because they're noticeable. I wouldn't say they're any less toxic, but we get the ability to challenge and contest those ideas when they're spoken aloud, put on T-shirts or posters or banners. And I think that one of the ways we might be able to sort of get at those ideas is not necessarily by centering on praise or blame, but to understand the logic and the justifications behind it, and then talk about those, that the justifications almost always are, I would like to enjoy violence and I don't really care about you. And that, you know, is a lot easier to have a conversation with than challenging culture or even sort of saying that you should feel bad for listening to particular songs or enjoying sports, etc. So I think that noticing and observing is that first step, developing that language and then figuring out how to best challenge it would be the strategic part.
Absolutely. And, you know, one thing that we were talking about just a little while ago, and Jennifer, that you brought up, that you were mentioning that, you know, television and songs don't necessarily, you know, change culture or whatnot. But, you know, I submit that they actually do, that they do have an influence, you know, both positive and negative. I mean, there have been some, you know, terrific positive things. I mean, it's there. I've seen many studies that showed Bill Cosby's absolute conscious effort when he did the Cosby Show, where he had an upper middle class family, where he was a doctor, and they were dealing with upper middle class problems. You know, it was a sitcom. Showed a black family dealing with upper middle class stuff, and it was on for a number of years, and it actually did actually contribute to the culture shift a little bit. I've seen things that showed that helped. And with regard to, there's been such a rapid culture shift with regard to such as same-sex marriage and just, you know, the whole queer community there has been such a shift in a very short amount of time. And again, one of the things that's been shown is that, you know, on television and a lot of quote unquote reality television, there are just many, many shows that have, you know, gay hosts that are absolutely, you know, normal people with good values, dealing with, you know, things that are just like everyday. You know, people become friends with these hosts and with the people on these shows, and it just becomes, wow, these people are kind of normal. They're just different from me. And it helps, I think, with the non-otherization. Now, it absolutely can go the other direction. there are plenty of cases where that is absolutely true.
Can I note that this is a good time to maybe mention that seemingly really nice and good guys also may very well be perpetrators of violence? And
sure.
Of course, that, you know, while we note Bill Cosby as a important role model in this particular show, mm-hmm. we also have recent conversations where it's been alleged that he's a serial perpetrator of sexual assault. And so there are a fair number of sort of threads in this case, but one of them that I would say that's kind of important is that even those folks who do good work may very well find themselves benefiting from entitlement or privilege mm-hmm. and engaging in acts of violence. And so, you know, it's one of the reasons why I think focusing necessarily on songs or on football
right.
doesn't necessarily get at the whole picture of the culture of violence. Instead, they almost become sort of, you know, scapegoats to not necessarily talk about the very normalized rate.
Right.
If we're talking about the numbers being as high for domestic violence or rape that they are, then we really can't imagine, we probably shouldn't imagine that there's one or two bad people out there doing it, but that mm-hmm. some of the trusted friends, family, and advisors that we sort of care about or believe in may very well also be perpetrators.
Absolutely. And while that is true, and I completely agree with you, the other side of that coin is that it also brings a conversation into a much broader audience, that more and more people are talking about domestic violence because of this. And you're absolutely right. It is amazingly widespread. And that's why we talk about this every single year.
I also want to say, I think that when we think about television, I teach a course on popular culture, and I think that it's a place, and I don't just mean television shows and things like mm-hmm. that, but I think it's a place where that is powerful in that I don't mean to suggest it doesn't help shape culture. It is culture. It is part of the air that we sure. breathe. It is part of the images that we have. But the evidence that shows that it actually directs individual behavior is slim to none. It seems to – the violence on television seems to be most likely to spur violence in those people who are already sort of – at a certain saturation point or will it or
oriented toward violence
right. oriented toward violence
right but, that's been shown many times
right.
same with video games and
right
whatnot.
Exactly. And you know, the I agree with you that having sort of positive or upper middle class role models say the Cosby Show, etc., were really good. But it's interesting because it's also, I think, one of the things that's contributed to when the recent research that looks at racial attitudes, for instance, which is one of my main areas is studying racism, is that whites increasingly believe that they suffer more oppression than African Americans do. That they have it worse, that it's harder for white people to get ahead than it is for black people to get ahead, that blacks and whites are relatively even in terms of income, et cetera. And so, which is completely false. I mean, all the evidence shows that is not true. But
now, are you showing that that's a majority of...
It's getting close to a majority. It's like almost 40% of the white population believes this.
That's remarkable.
Believes this. And so that is partly the effect of seeing all these images of upper middle class or upper class black people and not seeing the reality of the larger system, which has such differential access to the goodies in life for different people from different racial and ethnic groups. And in our local community, you know, we can think about what happens for indigenous people here, right? I mean, that when we think about intergenerational trauma and how things get passed down, that's absolutely the case for local native people who, you know, talk about this and what the effects are in their own community. But then what are the effects in the white community that people can still say to me, well, there's no diversity here. There's no, you know, it's so white. And it's like, well, only if you ignore the presence of, you know, seven recognized tribal groups plus other tribal and nation groups that aren't recognized, you know, so what does that invisibility do? And I think it links back to the invisibility of how women as 51% of the population can still be invisible in certain ways, right? It seems crazy, or how women can be othered. I mean, I think about in my own life how I was just talking about this at home the other day, that I realized how much through my life I've changed the way I look so that I don't get unwanted male attention.
Wow.
Like, I don't wear dresses and haven't probably for 20 years. Not because I don't think they're comfortable, but because when I do, it changes how men interact with me. And I don't like it. Mm-hmm. And so I stopped wearing dresses. I was following this thread online that was ongoing about this, and other women were talking about this, and I went, oh my God, I've done the exact same thing. And I hadn't put it in quite that language. Even being somebody who teaches about this stuff, thinks mm-hmm. about it, works mm-hmm. about it, the degree to which I've altered my own comfort level is profound.
Yeah.
I think that's why a lot of us have extra weight. Mm-hmm. We have extra weight so that we don't have sexualized bodies, so that we don't get that unwanted attention. And I was shocked that you were shocked that that woman experienced that 10 hours of verbal sexual harassment, because
I've never been a woman.
And it's still so common. And, you know, right. I moved up here from San Francisco, and I lived in San Francisco in my 20s, and that was every day in the Mission District. That was yeah. every day on Haight Street. That was every day. And then I was up here for about 3 or 4 months, and I thought, what is missing, aside from a lot of other things? But I could not have experienced that kind of degree of verbal and sexual harassment here. That did not happen. Mm-hmm. Now, it still happens episodically to lots and lots of women, but it's not to the same degree as it is in an urban environment. And I don't know whether it's because there's that anonymous kind of feeling when you're in an urban environment.
I think that helps.
But that is something that women still experience. So some behaviors are really hard to change. Mm-hmm. And this is on the continuum of sexism from, you know, just like, well, it's just words, right? But it really does say to you, you are not safe and you are not worthy to walk down the street undisturbed.
You know, it's just interesting what you mentioned, you know, that I found that so shocking when I saw that video. It's, you know, I know of intellectually that women get this kind of harassment, but I have not experienced it. And, you know, that was sort of a chance to experience it. Vicariously, but it's a chance to experience it. And, you know, it kind of speaks to the thing that that you were talking about when we were mentioning that almost the majority of whites now feel that they are more oppressed than other minorities. And it's kind of really a remarkable thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have never been black. However, one of my best friends who lives in Santa Rafael, who is not poor, he is quite well off and has been for a long time. And, you know, so he doesn't like live in the inner city, and he's not poor, and he drives expensive cars. And he has been pulled over by the police so many times he's lost count. He'd been driving down the street in his Porsche, pulled over. Where did you get that car? Yeah. Let me see the receipt. It's like, what?
And that's an example of aggression and violence.
Yes.
Because what it tells that African-American man who is well off, who's, you know, done all, quote, the right things, mm-hmm. is that you are still not safe. And the people you are not safe from are actually police. Mm-hmm. And that's really, I mean, we talk about this a lot in the criminology and justice studies program, where for many of the white students, they see the police as being a positive, right? If something's wrong, you go to the police. But for many of the students of color, that is not their experience at all. And then it makes it even more difficult. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at Bill right now. It makes it even more difficult for people to feel like this is a that there's any safety, because often the people who are going to visit the most violence on you in your community are the police. And so and that's state-sanctioned violence. So what does it right. tell you then about what you're, who you are in the system?
Right.
It tells you you don't belong, and not only do you not belong, but you're hunted.
Right. And this, you know, what I was talking about is happening here in California, Northern California, you know, a nice liberal bastion. But what about if you're in, you know, if you're a poor kid in Missouri?
Well, we know what happened.
I mean, that was that has been you know, headlines now for quite some time, and it's a problem.
Yeah, and that's that hierarchical ladder of value, and you can, I mean, you can actually just graph it. You know, who's on the top and who's under that, and you draw a line, and everybody under, you know, sort of, you know, the certain gender that is the specified gender, as in the Bible. You know, then you have everybody under that, and that's all objects, and you can do things to the objects, and the objects don't have the same rights and privileges. And I know it sounds simplistic, but in actuality, that's how it really plays out.
And I want to say, it's I know around race, and I say this a lot to people who have to listen to me, and you don't, of course, you can always change the dial, but it's
no,
easy.
Please don't do that.
It's easy. Well, yes, please don't do that. But it's easy for white people, I'm a white person, to think of the people who are the real problem as being, say, whites in the South or whites somewhere else, right? And the South is a great a scapegoat for white oppression elsewhere. It's like, oh no, we're not the problem, it's the South. I have never lived anywhere, and I have lived in the South. I've never lived anywhere where people were not painting swastikas on people's doors, that were not writing the N-word, go home. It happened here when I first moved here at CR. There was some African-American students who were targeted with hate speech on their doors. It happens up at the university. It happens in our community. One of the reasons we have attrition or students of color who don't stay is not only because of what their experience on the college campus, right. but it's because of what they experience in the community. Right. It's a major issue. And so it's even here in little liberal Humboldt County that many of our students of color do not feel safe at all. They do not feel welcome at all. And then when they tell somebody about it, the white person acts surprised and says, well, I can't imagine that. It's such a welcoming community. And it's like, well, obviously it's not. It's not welcoming to everybody.
No, to be followed around in the store, to be watched, to be, you know.
Have people yell things at you. Yeah. Have people not want to rent you an apartment because of the color of your skin. All those things are happening here. We don't even. And I'd like to also call attention that we have a number of killings that have happened. One that I was quite close to, of an African American, that don't really get solved or really get dealt
That's
with.
Right.
And there are these murders of people, you know, people of color in our community. And so, you know, we can look at Ferguson, and Ferguson is a powerful example of a long spiral that keeps happening and happening and happening. But we have similar things that happen.
And again, sort of like the Ray Rice situation, the Ferguson thing, while we can all point to Missouri and say that's a Missouri problem, and of course it is, but it is also, again, opens the dialogue to a much broader issue, which is, you know, we are all kind of Ferguson, Missouri, yeah. aren't we? I mean, there is yeah, everything that we all need to really take a good close look at.
Well, there's... Yeah, I mean, we're talking about lots of different things in culture and systems, and our justice system, which sometimes is just, has all kinds of evidence of disproportionality of minority persons in lockup and coming through the system. And I wouldn't paint all law enforcement with the brush that
no.
they're bad or
oh,
that
no.
they're out targeting people of color just because.
And
but our
that.
System does set up an advantage for certain persons. That's a fact. And I think that we as a community have a responsibility. I mean, we're talking about what can we do. I think we have a responsibility to continue to shine the light on things. It's done through different media, like you've talked about, Cliff. You know, television shows and so forth. News articles, through conferences, through just discussions in classrooms and within our own homes and within our businesses. And I know as a department head with our you know, with our county and being in kind of the hub of the justice system in probation, that I have a responsibility to make sure my staff are exposed to the latest research and knowledge that can expose some of these myths, fallacies, practices that are disproportional, and look at ways that we can change our internal practices to make sure that people are treated fairly, that we're considering all the factors that are coming into play that are bringing people before us, and what the profound responsibility is that we have in trying to help them to change their lives and live more in community with everybody else.
And I believe we may have someone trying to get in on this conversation. Let's go to the phone. No, I'm afraid they gave up. So, if you ever get a ring, just let it keep ringing until we get a chance to answer it, because we do not have operators standing by. It's just
me. Screeners here.
Just me. So just be patient, and I will get to it as soon as I can, assuming I notice it, because we don't have it ringing in here, just a flashing light. All right, which is a good place for me to step out. We've got to take a quick break. Let our sponsors say a few words, and we will continue on with our dialogue dealing with the culture of aggression for our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign here on KHUM. All righty. You got it on KHUM. We continue our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign here on KHUM. We are dealing with the culture of aggression. And again, it looks like we've got someone calling in. Let's see if we can put them on the air. Are you there? No, and still not there. Okay. Well, one of these days, they will actually still be there. Alrighty, so we've touched on a lot of different things, and we actually lost Bill. He had to go off back doing his real job, and Sherry is escorting him out, but she will be back. So, you know, one of the interesting things that we were talking about was various different different racial things, and we were talking about how, you know, the South is an interesting, you know, very easy place to point a finger. But, you know, the reason that is such an easy place is that there really is a heightened level of racism. And, you know, I had my own personal experience several years ago when I was consulting a radio station in Mobile, Alabama. And, you know, Mobile is a wonderful old historic town, and it's as deep South gets. And I was kind of shocked, you know, being that, you know, I'm just your average-looking white guy. One thing about my ethnicity is it doesn't show, is, you know, I'm Jewish, 100%. And you can't tell by my eyes or the color of my skin or any of that. So I was just kind of brought into the fold as, you know, as one of the boys. And things that were said around me were just like shocking. I mean, I could not believe the things that were said around me because I was just one of the boys. And it was just, it was mind-numbing. Yes.
You know, I think if you are a man in this culture, then you've had similar sorts of moments about women. You know, and I think there's sort of an amazing moment when you're suddenly invited in, let's say, an all-male space at a bar to sort of collectively objectify someone at the end of the bar.
I think every man has been in that situation.
You know, and again, sort of racial conversations, assumptions about sexuality, you know, a sort of crew of straightish assumed folks who wind up saying something really toxic about lesbians or something like that. You know, there's something like, I think a lot of the violence and hierarchy that we've been talking about rides on the back of really normal conversations where we're actually likely to be in the mix. You know, and one of the more difficult things that I would say, and again, I think it's while we talk about the large meta things, like how do you have that discussion at Thanksgiving where somebody makes a racist joke or a really sexist comment or something? How do you talk to people that you love and care about prejudicial attitudes? And, you know, I honestly think that the you know, there's just something amazing about when you do have privilege, if you have that benefit where, let's say, you get white skin privilege and people assume that you're white to the nth degree, you know, in some ways you get access to hear racist conversations that other people with different skin color don't necessarily get access to. And are you willing to maybe share a little bit of that benefit and say, all right, these people might think I'm a sort of judgmental leftist or something, but I got to say that that joke not only wasn't funny, but it was offensive, and you maybe might want to think about that a little bit. And that's really hard to do.
That's exactly right. Now, and I think we've all been in situations too where, you know, you know you know, guys sometimes around that group, around that bar, and things are being said, and what's hard is, you know, not conforming to those ideas and just to fit in, and that's kind of a big deal that you see, you know, as well as, and I know I've been parts of groups that, you know, there's stuff that that shouldn't be said. And around the culture, you know, we're in, and around the you know, guys and around at the bar and talking about a certain, you know, it's hard. It's really difficult for a lot of people to step away from that and go, you know what, that's not right. And I think that's where it falls on us as, you know, professors in colleges and coaches at the collegiate level, anywhere, to fall on. And we have to be that person who make sure we observe it and see it and put a stop to it. We have a saying around our program. It's thumbs up or thumbs down. There's no middle ground. There's no you're in or you're out. I mean, it's this or this. We always throw the thumbs up, thumbs down. There is no middle ground. There shouldn't be a middle ground. Well, I'm just going to sit tight and just kind of just nod my head and smile. There's got to be a stop to it. There's got to be something where, and that's where it falls on us coaches and leaders of young people to make sure that when we see it, because it's hard. We only get them for a couple hours a day. But when we see something happen or see someone, you know, who's, you know, of the good character, people conforming to things that, you know, that aren't right or that aren't in the best regard to that person being, you know, going on and being a successful human being. And it's our job to nip that in the butt when we see it, and also make sure that we're handling our business from that standpoint of always conducting ourselves in a way that we don't fall short.
Well, yeah. I think what happens is that people think if I'm silent, I'm not participating, then I'm not really involved with that. I'm not really supporting that.
But that is tacit approval.
It is, and it's really hard to call something out. And I really liked in your interview, Max, when you were talking about doing this, and I think this is a really important topic, is that sometimes it's better to, like, pull somebody aside or there's an opportunity to have a private conversation.
Right. You don't need to necessarily just embarrass in front of everybody, but it's like you got to say something.
Yeah, but in other times you have to say something. But I think we have to say something in a way that isn't self-righteous, that isn't correcting, that isn't scolding, but is heartfelt.
And letting them know that it's not okay.
Yeah, and because I'm on a crusade to have everyone examine when they use the B word and why they're using the B word and what is the behavior that we're talking about actually. And so I say in my world, that word is used in a really derogatory way, and you ask a five-year-old, is that a good word or a bad word? And how do we explain to little girls that we get to be called names? And
so
that
just
that's
for clarification,
okay.
The B word, are we talking the other name for a female dog?
Yes, we are. Thank you. So, and then I just say, in my world, I really don't want to hear that word unless it is in reference to a female dog.
Right.
So, so can we have a conversation about what you really mean by that word? And it's hard because there sometimes it's with people I really love and care about, and they're talking about complaining, only they're using the being, you know, and so I have to kind of interrupt and stop our flow of conversation to be able to say, you know, do you mean complaining? Is that so? Everybody has to develop their own way of doing it, and they have to develop when they're going to do it and have to feel comfortable and safe enough to do it. But if you make a commitment to do it, things change.
This is KHUM, Cutton, Eureka, Arcata, and Blue Lake, and streaming on the web at KHUM.com. It's our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. We're dealing with the culture of aggression. And, Taylor, one thing that you mentioned was, you know, if you're in this crowd, and we've all been in the crowd where a group of men are objectifying women. And one thing, you know, is, you know, one tough thing is that as human beings, we all want to be able to fit in.
Yeah.
And stepping up to the plate and saying that is not okay, it takes some courage to do that. But, you know, it's you know, part of being a man is finding that courage and saying something. And it's really only people doing that actually changes the culture. I mean, you actually have to say that's just not okay.
I think that that's crucial, and I really appreciate this conversation. I think that I would extend it out even to not only in our roles as teachers, coaches, et cetera, but just in your role in your, as a human being, that how important it is. And I really fundamentally believe that men have to step up to the plate around this, because when women do, we are the B word. We are, we're bad people because we don't have a sense of humor, blah, 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 blah,
We're just not happy.
Yeah. But so men, you have to call other men out on this. You have to be responsible for your brothers, period. I can't do it. When I do it, I'm dismissed. In the same way that I think white people have to break out of the white club and go and say, if we're uncomfortable, if you witness something and you're standing there and you're uncomfortable, you got to say it. And you can't just turn to, if there's a person of color in the group, to see if they're going to react. And if they don't react, then it's okay. There's a lot of reasons somebody may not react. They may not react because they don't individually mind it. They may not react because they're outnumbered, you know, and they don't want to be ostracized from the group. So it's absolutely essential that people who have power, social power, take this on.
Right. There's something to be said about that. You know, you're the only person in that group. You know, you're going to step up and say, way, you know, that takes something. I mean, I will admit, you know, there were times when I was younger and there I was in a group of people. And again, my ethnicity doesn't show. And someone was making some Jew joke, you know, it was like, and I didn't go like, hey, I was like,
and you know, that may be a tactic. As Sherry says, we need to embrace the thought that you need a couple of different tools in your toolbox to be successful and strategic, which means compassionate engagement, which may very well mean that space isn't necessarily safe for you to say that's an anti-Semitic joke that I want to challenge. And that those multiple tools is hard to get at. The line that jumps out at me from what Jennifer was saying was that someone had said this recently to me that stuck in my head, that women are men are afraid that women will make fun of them and women are afraid that men will kill them.
Wow.
Right? Which is that sense that, you know, when we're talking about an imbalance of power, if we're talking about an imbalance of power, then it is possible that you could be mortified in that situation. That you may be made fun of.
I mean, that's really an amazing statement, though.
Yeah. You know, when you said that, it actually, I felt it at such a visceral level that was really painful, but is really absolutely true. You know, I talk about how we don't, in my own house, like, if I forget to lock my door and somebody comes in when I'm not there and steals stuff, that's a bummer. But now I'm middle class and I have insurance, right? So life will go on. I most want my doors locked when I'm home.
Yeah.
My doors are always locked when I'm home because I'm afraid of being killed in my home. I'm afraid of being raped in my home. I'm afraid – that's what I'm afraid of in my home. I'm not afraid of someone coming in and stealing my shit.
And men might be demasculinated, right? Might be called various names, insulted with sexuality. You know, that might be the cost of saying, hey, I think this sexist joke at the bar isn't cool. But even, you know, I think we're also talking about a moment where if you have heterosexual privilege and you sort of understand the stakes in society, then we're talking about hate crimes against gay, lesbian, and transgender folk at all-time high. And so, you know, it's a similar sort of situation, which is that you may very well get made fun of, but the cost of sort of allowing those violent ideas to kind of carry through on other people's bodies may very well be death. And so are you willing to sort of share that risk and have each other's backs? And it may very well be embarrassing or difficult at points, but if you have that privilege, I think you got to spend it.
Are you willing to be an ally? In just a second, Taylor, but because an ally is somebody who has your back and you can count on and is a dependable voice and then still has to judge when and how and in what ways. But when we make that commitment to be an ally, all struggles are our struggles.
Say share risk. Oh, I'm sorry.
No. I just what comes to my mind is that commercial you see every once in a while where one person does one good thing, and then that person does that, and the whole thing just kind of comes back. It's a real powerful commercial, and everybody's kind of seen it, and it's the same. You know, I would respect someone who, if I made a comment around, you know, a pub, and someone came up to me in a emotional or a, you know, heartfelt way and said, you know what, that I don't appreciate hearing that. If that was not a what are we doing this? It just came up to me. I would be taken aback, but I would respect that person for standing up in the right way. And then in turn might make me look about how I would go about my business. And, you know, I just keep thinking about that commercial is always really influential. And but, you know, it all does.
Yeah, I think the willingness of somebody to say, hey, I heard you say this thing, and I don't know if you know this or not, but that's really insulting to people, is a generous moment. It really says that, you know, I think you could possibly hear that. And so if you are one of the folks who winds up getting explained or hearing, you know, I've always said this and never really thought about it, just be aware that that person holds you in high enough esteem that they think you could change or that this might make sense to you. It's a generous, compassionate moment to explain a sort of racist or a sexist joke to somebody. And what I'd interrupted Taylor with, and I apologize for that, was thinking about the fact that my definition of allies would be someone who shares risk, right, which is willingness to say, in this world, women are killed, beaten, and raped for speaking up. I'm willing to at least speak up as well and possibly not share the same risk, but be willing to share that situation. And it's not
Maxwell, you bring a really good point, is that a man speaking up absolutely does not share the same risk. Mm-hmm. You know, we have way less at stake for maybe a bruise to our pride or ego to speak up. Yeah. That's a really, really good point. Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I would also say, and I know at the moment we're talking about sexualized violence against women, but that men do experience a tremendous amount of violence from other men, right? And there are some people out there who argue that men experience a great deal of violence from women. There's, you know, a group that sort of argues that, you know, women also commit violence against men, and which is true. Women do
about 85 to 15.
Right.
The statistics are consistent.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
85% male to female, 15% male to female to male. But of that 15%, we don't know how much of that is fighting back.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Retaliation.
Yeah.
And I think that if we go back to the larger issue of culture, that larger issue of violence and what it means to be a man, I think is a really important issue, because men experience such a large amount of violence from other men.
And that microaggression, too, the kind of just like and I know that's part of that kind of the culture, but the way that men talk to each other or call each other names in order to strengthen them, they'll call them other kinds of words, but go ahead.
Yeah, and that's, you take that and times it by 100 and put it in a football locker room.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's the whole deal you're seeing, you know, with all the Martin from Miami Dolphins, the guy in the hazing deal that kind of comes involved with that. This is being in a locker room, and they compare it to a kind of a construction site environment.
Yeah. Or military.
Or a military environment, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that's just, it's just, you take that and just multiply it because of the game you play or just the competitive nature of these guys. And it's difficult. It is difficult. You see it all over. But in the game of football, it's such a violent sport. So everything's just, you know, just the magnitude of it is just.
And what was amazing to me about the case that you're talking about with the young man who, you know, left football in relation to that hazing was that how much the attack was turned on him and how classic that is, right? It was like he just needed to toughen up. Yeah. He needed to, you know, that's just the way it is. What was his problem? All this kind of stuff. And it was just like, really? You know, that
this was beyond hazing, though.
It was, but that's the way it was framed.
It was framed that way, and there was a community shift, because basically the football coach basically pulled the entire season, and they were saying, that's a huge overreaction with hazing, and until it came out what actually took place.
But it's using these words like hazing.
Right.
Like,
this is not
so it
hazing.
Has like a kind of collegey, you know, feeling to it. Yeah, you know, like getting spanked on the butt, you know. Because we've been thinking about, and we had, you know, somebody who we're close to want us to talk about the term child pornography, which really, instead of just saying child sexual abuse,
right?
You know, it's like you put these terms on things, and we distance ourselves from the actual acts of abuse that are taking place. So
I actually do want to talk on that, because that is a something that really needs to get brought up.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in week two and three.
Yes, we will.
That thread just runs through.
Absolutely. But I think we got to take a quick break, let our sponsors say a few words. And again, I would like to remind you that if you've got something you would like to add to the conversation, a question that you have, by all means, call 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486. You can also send your question to studio at KHUM.com. All right, you do have it on KHUM. It is 22 minutes after 9 o'clock, and I had someone who wanted to make a comment but didn't necessarily want to go on the air, but hopefully you don't have to give your name. If you would like to still make your comment, you may.
That's fine. The thing that I wanted to say, it has been my own experience that when one does speak out, the response is really positive. People come up and say, that was a good thing to say, that was smart, that was the right thing to do, and it spreads. And I think that that's a really a truly valid point, to realize that when you do say something, people hear it and respond in a very good way. And that's what I had to say.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling. And again, I would like to extend the invitation to anyone who has a question or a comment to make at 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486. If you get a ring, just let it keep going until I get a chance to answer it. So, you know, we were talking about sexist comments and whatnot, but you know, one thing that we were talking about a little bit off air was certain things of our vernacular that have become so common we don't actually realize that they are sexist. But you know, Maxwell, you were mentioning the term like pimp, you know.
Yeah,
a real pimp. He's pimping out his ride.
Yeah, pimp has a sort of complementary masculinity story to it. And, you know, a synonym, obviously, would be sex slaver.
Right.
And I think that it doesn't necessarily have that same charming ring that pimp does. And so, you know, again, I think if, you know, if you put in sort of a synonym, you get some way to really make visible the power operation and why that compliment works. You know, the reason why you would compliment someone who was pimping was that they had successfully exploited a number of people to sort of make themselves more grand, and that's, you know, a backwards compliment at the worst, I guess. So.
Yeah,
that's and it's funny, you know, and this the word pimp, and people, you know, they, I think they know what it means, but they don't realize what it means, or I you know, I mean, they don't understand. I mean, there's a my girlfriend and I really like this Key and Peele. It's a,
oh yeah, they're wonderful
comedy deal. These guys do great skits and are real entertaining. And there's one where you know, they're in, it's a, they set the scene and it's a club, and there's a bunch of guys and girls on the dance floor, and the DJ's kind of over you know, over the loudspeaker, you know, if there's any pimps in here, put your hands up, as the song's going on. And of course all the guys, they want to be that pimp, you know, and raising their hands and holding their hands up as they're dancing. And the DJ then goes on, which is the skit, goes on to explain what the, you know, if you're a woman abuser, keep your hands up. And then if you know, sell women for money, keep your hands up. And then everybody kind of slowly starts putting their hands down, not you know, of course, not wanting to react to that. That's not what they are, but they just, you know, it's that same thing. The word is just, it's amazing how words twist.
Absolutely.
It.
They just become part of the vernacular. And, you know, it's like there is, I don't know if it's as popular now as it was a few years ago, but I know in high school, and I know it's been addressed a lot at Eureka High and Arcata High, is using the word gay. I mean, that's just so gay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's just so gay.
And they don't mean it in a nice way.
They don't
way.
Mean it as like, wow, that's really well decorated or something like that. They just mean it's a put down. You know, that's so gay. And it's like, do you know what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, no.
Mm-mm.
No.
So everybody says that.
Yeah, everyone says that.
Yeah.
Which is not an excuse.
No, I mean, I think it's interesting in that we get the visibility, and it reminds me of the, you know, you talking about the B word and the sort of comfort of it, to think about the context of complaining as that. And the very, I mean, I think one of the values of someone expressing those sorts of things, saying that's so gay, to mean that that's terrible, is that you really can quickly say,
you really mean that the definition, the existence of someone's life is terrible by means of comparison and contrast. Do you really sort of believe that what would make you special and important as a man is exploitation of someone else? And it's pretty quick. It doesn't take too long to say, hey, you know, actually what's visible in that language is something kind of poisonous. And, you know, most people, once they have that sort of thought, it takes a little while, but then you say, boy, I'm not entirely sure that that's really where I want to, you know, sort of put my politics out when I speak in public.
Go ahead, Jennifer.
Well, I was just going to say, I also wanted to acknowledge the caller who called in about, you know, when he speaks up that he's gotten a really positive response. Sorry, I got the word order wrong. And that a lot of us are so terrified that if we speak up, if we say something, whether it's reframing the word for somebody like, oh, it's not a pimp, it's a sex slaver, you want to be that? That it's going to be a really horrible thing, and that we are so afraid of rejection. I think fundamentally people are herd creatures. You know, we like to be in a herd, and we don't like to be out of the herd, and we don't like to be rejected. And so we're very fearful. Many people are very fearful of being excluded. And but what you're hearing what I'm hearing as I'm listening is ways to do it, ways to intervene, and ways to speak up that aren't belittling, aren't like, oh, you're a bad person because you said, you know, you said that. It's more, you know, we can be more thoughtful in that, and to really encourage people to do that. And once you start doing it, it will become easier. Now, my experience of having been somebody who says things for the last, I don't know, 28 years or so, is that it still is not easy. My blood pressure goes up. Mm-hmm. I can feel my heart rate racing as I know I'm going to say something right. I'm like, oh, man. But it's still easier now. And if you get in the habit of doing it, it will become your habit. It'll never be, quote, easy. But I love hearing from the caller that the response is positive, because there's also great reward in doing what is right and living with integrity. There is great reward in that.
Absolutely.
And we forget that. And so I just wanted to acknowledge the caller and say that these are different examples. And I also wanted to call attention to the work that the Sexualized Assault Prevention Committee at Humboldt is doing with this great program that's come out of student work, which is called Check It. And Maxwell is the co-chair of that committee, and maybe can speak to that a little bit. But, you know, really thinking about how to encourage people and give them the skills so that they do have a couple things in their pockets when they see something going down that shouldn't be going down, how to intervene, even in ways that are, you know, whether it's just doing something distracting, like dropping a cup, you know, on the ground so it startles everyone. Yeah, exactly. It changes things, or going up and asking, oh, what time is it? Or can you give me directions to, you know, just ways that you can also redirect or interrupt behavior and even if it's in that moment you don't want to and don't feel you have the capacity to go into why the word is wrong or why the behavior is wrong, but you can still intervene. So
I just want to jump in real quick, because before Max talks about Check It and Cliff says something, but it's we have the need to belong. I mean, as social creatures, we want to belong. I mean, you know, no infant raises itself in the forest unless it's raised by wolves, but that's another story. But we need to, like, have a feeling of belonging and purpose and meaning and connection. And so when we separate ourselves out to say something, it is scary. It is that absolutely. We will have that physiological response to it. But we belong to something bigger after that. Right. And that's why I love the Check It campaign. And I love being able to name behaviors as opposed to taking the label off the veneer, the covering, and then say, what is it we're really talking about? What's the behavior?
And one thing, you know, the caller said that he's gotten nothing but positive response. Even if you get negative response, one thing to keep in mind is that often the negative response you're going to get back is saving face.
That's right.
And the reality is your comment will sink in. There will be some place where that is registered, where it's like, wow, I'm getting negative feedback from something I was expecting a high five from. And eventually it will even even the negative response will make a difference. And Maxwell, let's hear about Check It.
Sure. Check It is the bystander intervention, bystander accountability program at Humboldt State, run and organized by students for students. And it's built around the idea that there might be a multitude of ways that you could challenge moments of violence, that you're really likely to be around someone when an incident of violence happens, that there's almost always folks who could very well speak up and say something. And you know, one of the sort of the great thoughts about that is that, you know, we're sort of, especially in a culture of aggression, we're sort of trained, and especially as men, to sort of like nose-to-nose confront. I'm going to take you outside the bar and challenge you, buddy, you know. And honestly, Check It is rejection of that idea that it's sort of a macho showdown sort of thing. And instead, it's an encouragement that just about anybody, even the quietest or most thoughtful person, could maybe do something. And it may not necessarily be in that traditional confrontation way, but you know, generating adrenaline sort of showdown thing is almost never a way that people calm down and think about stuff. You know, how do you tactically think about a situation where there's interpersonal violence going on and imagine a way where you could better support the person who's experiencing it, better sort of frame the situation for other folks to ask for help? I mean, if there's, you know, one or two other people around, is it possible to delegate, to say, look, I'm not the kind of person who confronts, but I happen to be here with eight or nine of my other friends. Is anybody else here comfortable being able to help with this situation? And eight or nine people is a real different situation than some kind of one versus one thing. And I do think that, you know, if you're thinking about confrontation out there, please frame it in the way Jennifer was talking about it, which is strategic. The goal is change. The goal is, you know, actually making and encouraging people to think differently, not necessarily the feeling of self-righteousness. And something I'd said in the interview with Cliff that I'll say again, which is that you may not be in the safety or the situation where you can actually do that. And I think that's a fruitful time to wait and prepare for the next time.
Sure.
Odds are really good that you're going to run into somebody else who's going to say it. So even if you can't get it together in that particular moment, don't carry too much guilt on that. Prepare, practice, think, and try to be better the next time.
And it's kind of an interesting thing when you think about actual going to violence to try and change someone's mind. And it's like, well, let's look at the physiology of it. When you head into violence, your rational brain shuts down. You are, you know, you are the most primitive part of your brain has at that point taken over. There is no rational thought. You aren't changing anybody's mind. And all that's happening is people are getting hurt.
There was some years ago, there was an escalating domestic violence situation on campus, and the woman was obviously frightened, and the man was really escalating, and so I intervened, and he said, "This isn't your business." And I said, "Well, actually, yes, it is." So, and we were able to, like, you know, kind of separate and get her away to safety, but sometimes humor is good, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're actually down to the last part of our 2 hours here, which is kind of hard to believe. We've got to take a break, let our sponsors say a couple of words, and we will continue on with our first roundtable discussion in our 19th Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign, dealing with the culture of aggression here on KHUM. Our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues. It is 9:38, and again, I want to send out the invitation to anyone who wants to join in on the conversation, either with a question or a comment. The number is 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486. You can also send it by email, studio@khum.com. You are not required to give your name unless you want to. That is your decision.
It's so, always wonderful to hear people and their lived experience and to add to the conversation. So please, if you're courageous enough, just give us a call at 786-5486.
Fantastic. So one of the things that we touched on that I want to make sure we, you know, explore a little deeper, we've been talking about, you know, how about racism and otherization and whatnot. And one thing we touched on was that that women are probably the number one object of otherization, and they are. Women are the majority of the population of this planet, which is absolutely amazing. Do we have a? Oh, we do have a caller. Thank you for pointing that out to me. I do appreciate that. Okay, let's go.
How many people does it take? Yeah, to?
Let's go to the phones. Hello, you are on the air. Hello. Oh, One more time. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Cliff. Hey, I just wanted to put in there that I think religions are a main factor in violence against women across the board. And that's really the elephant that we're not talking about here, because that's, you know, you guys were talking about how everybody wants to belong. Well, you know, they play right to that note, and they've bred a theory of violence against women for a long, long time. So, anyway, that's my two cents.
Thank you very much. Okay, well, that's an interesting point, where, you know, the role that religion plays.
It's huge. And thank you, caller, for bringing that up. It is very traditionally, most of the world's major religions have stressed or have embedded in them from the very beginning the idea that women are inferior to men, and that God or the divine speaks to men and not to women, and that women are either the...
Indirectly speaks. You have to go through the man to get to the guy. To the big guy.
Right. Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. So
you mentioned it, big guy.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I won't use the term. Never mind. I'll avoid it. But I think that it is really true that religion has played a large role. And what has been, what I've looked at a lot of the different sort of feminist rethinkings or rewritings, like in Judaism and in Christianity, and even within the Muslim faith, around a different reading of the divine or ways to understand even original texts. And I think that that is really powerful. It's just very difficult because so many places and people who frame themselves as deeply religious still hold these beliefs. I know one of the people who was elected, not out of Missouri, but somewhere out of the South, this last Tuesday, you know, one of his public statements is he thinks it's fine for women to be involved in politics as long as they're still under the authority of the men in their life. And he was elected to Congress. So and he's a preacher as well. That's the context. And so I think that people of faith who do not accept this and who do not accept this framing also need to stand up to other people of faith and make their voices heard, because in a lot of large political campaigns and in a large public framing, the voices that we hear are the ones that are framed as traditional. But I know many people of faith who have very different interpretations, but they don't have the same public voice, and I think they need to be more public.
And I think that needs to be addressed as well. And let's continue this conversation in a moment. But we do have another person wanting to get in on the conversation. So let's go to the phones. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I wanted to make a comment.
Please.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you for bringing our awareness to this habitual way that we sometimes talk and think and behave, and that the concept that it costs us is to be nervous and scared and to speak up, and that's what it costs to have integrity. That's how you grow.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, just want to thank you guys.
Well, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Uh-huh.
You too.
And an acknowledgement to anyone who calls in, because it does take courage to actually get on the air and talk to thousands of people at the same time. I mean, I do it regularly. To me, it's nothing, but I guess to most of you, it's something. So we were talking about the role of religion in this, and it's an interesting thing, because one thing that you mentioned was that it's not necessarily religion, it's interpretation, and you look at the books of religion. And these are all written by men, okay?
And they threw away the Book of Mary.
Right. And these are all, some people say they were written by God. They were written by men. And, but if you
even... Except for the Book of Mary.
Right. But which was thrown out. But if you even look back at some of the original texts, the only thing I can speak of is... the original Bible in its original language of Hebrew, where the word God has now is always portrayed as a man, is actually just a space holder. Right. There is no word for God. So it's not a man, not a woman, yeah. not anything. You know, it's there is a space holder.
Right.
There is no actual thing there. You know, it was reinterpreted, you know, as Adonai, as the space holder, but it is not, there is no word for God in the original Bible in Hebrew, which is an interesting thing, which is not to say that there's still not lots of sexist things, because, you know, this was 5,000 years ago, and, about a couple thousand years ago.
Yeah.
A couple thousand years ago. And it was a sexist world then. It still is. Probably even more so even then.
Let me add in one other element.
Please.
And, you know, I think that we're looking at a particular story which justifies inequality or says that this is okay or normal or preordained maybe from somebody. And I thought the caller made a really good point, but I almost think that it's almost too focused again. I think the real interesting part is the sense that anybody who would say, like, oh, this is, you know, inequality, that's just the way things are, you better get used to it. I think that's worth, you know, it's something similar to the other toxic language we've been talking about, which is that it gets spoken aloud, it gets written into books, and then we can analyze it and contest it. And I think that that's a kind of vulnerability of prejudicial ideas, which is that if you say it out loud and you say, oh, God says that you're going to have to be unequal, you know, there's a moment where a few people may be affirmed, but a lot of other people are like, that kind of raises a few other questions about the rest of the thing. And, you know, feminist, one of the easiest definitions of feminism is that to make the personal political, which is to take those things which would otherwise be hidden behind closed doors or said, you don't talk about that because it's what happens in the home, and say that's political and real and it's part of the political fabric of our lives. And I think that that also sort of intersects with that idea of religion or faith.
And again, you know, we've had this really stimulating conversation and just talked about a lot of different landscapes. But bringing it down to what individual people can do in their lives, and we've talked some about that. And I've been teaching a mindfulness practice working with trauma class and have been inspired by how students have been able to name traumatic events and in people's lives and their lives and in the work that they're doing, and then talk about how they've applied their mindfulness practice and that they have been able to breathe through some really hard stuff and come up with a different response. So I am inviting everyone to just try to take deep breaths when they feel that they're in situations of challenge and just really have a quiet moment to be able to respond in a different way, because the culture of aggression is a conditioned response, and we think we have to do that, and we have to meet that threat with an equal threat in order to defend ourselves. And when we breathe through a moment, there is often at times a creative solution that we wouldn't have normally come up with. So it's the easiest thing to do. We all have to do it. We all have to breathe. But sometimes if we just breathe to the count of four and hold to the count of four and out to the count of four and hold to the count of four again and just take 3 to 5 deep breaths, we can respond in a different way. We don't have to respond in the ways that our conditioning has narrowed and trapped us in. Or our epigenetics, the way that our grandparents or their parents responded. We can be different in our commitment to an alternative to violence.
Absolutely. And, you know, one thing that we have going for us as human beings is that we don't necessarily do everything on instinct. We learn and then we act. And the way that we behave is a product of what we have learned. And the nice thing is that we can learn new things constantly. We can constantly be growing. We don't have to be locked into any of our original beliefs. You know, in the 57 years I've been on the planet, things have changed a lot. Mm-hmm. And attitudes have changed with many different things, and mine along with them. You know, it's like, you know, you go back, you know, to the 60s and how certain things were looked at, and you just went along with that. But as things changed, you know, you can change your mind, too. You don't have to be locked into what was then. You know, you live in now, and you have a mind.
some ideas corrode against other ideas, that you speak aloud certain notions of inclusion and it makes ideas of exclusion harder to make sense for. And I think that's the sort of way that culture changes. And if we're talking about changing the culture of violence, then fighting the culture of violence, again, is probably betrays a certain kind of showdown attitude. But transforming that is a real sense that you need to have something else, a different way of existing. And I'm optimistic that I think we can get there.
Well, I mean, just overall, I mean, it just sounds like the feedback, even from the callers, are saying the positive responses and everything that we've had, and just overlying, just me, you know, just being here and talking with, you know, you guys has just been, it shows that there is hope for healing, you know, and there is that, because there is that positive response out there, that if you just got to take that plunge and try it, and there's hope that we can get this thing right and get better.
I know this will sound like a strange, it may sound like a strange segue. I hope it's not. In addition to doing this work I do, I'm also a dog trainer. And
we specialize in strange segues,
yeah,
here at Canine
exactly.
Health.
So
dogs.
I mention that because there's humans do try to separate ourselves and say that we're incredibly unique and that we can reflect on our behavior. Animals reflect on their – non-human animals reflect on their behavior all the time. I mean, it's amazing to take a dog that is showing aggression towards other dogs or towards people and to teach it to have a different emotional response. And you do that through rewarding the behavior you want and not the behavior you don't want. So you can work with dogs that are having aggression and teach them a different response so that they actually have a happy emotional response when they see someone else coming, because good things are going to come to them when they look to their human companion.
It's called a conditioned response.
That's
works
right.
With humans just
it,
as it does
exactly.
With doggies.
So if you reward, so this whole line of training that I've come out of to be a dog trainer is very much about you reward the positive and you either ignore the negative or you work to transform it. And you never do it through violence, and you don't do it through, you know, teaching the dog who's boss. That's the old school. And I think that it's this exact same thing with us. And so if we reward the behavior we want in others and ourselves and tell people so that when they're, you know, we're saying, I love that. It was so good that you were kind in that moment. I love that you spoke up, right? So somebody speaks up and then you go away and you say to them, man, you spoke up. I'm so proud of you. And I really, that feeds the cultural shift. And so, you know, reward, what is rewarded is repeated. That is the key. What is rewarded is repeated, that both in dogs and in humans, right? And in chickens, because you can train chickens. You can train all sorts of animals to do all sorts of things. And so reward what you want.
Same works for negative, by the way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we can, you know, condition negative behavior just as well. And that's where a lot of this, you know, came from, because much of this, you know, the things we're talking about, like at the bar and, you know, objectifying women, you know, there can be some positive feedback that you're getting for that. Yeah, right on!
Right, so you reward, right. In that case, you're rewarding negative behavior.
Exactly.
And so you're going to continue the behavior. So you have to reward, you have to be careful with rewards, right? They reward what you want.
It works both ways.
Yes.
It absolutely does. We are just about out of time. So I think what I want to do is give everyone a minute to say their closing thoughts. So I guess we'll just kind of go around the room and we'll start with you, Taylor.
Yeah, no, I kind of just mentioned as well, as just it was real informative, and if anything, I just hope it, you know, opens some people's eyes to make them take that first step and say something, you know, and so it was real good.
All right, Maxwell?
I really appreciate the space. I want to thank you for the years of putting in work on the issue, and I think that, you know, we tend to think about sort of activists as something separate than people who have regular jobs, and I think everybody has the capacity to be a culture changer, and if you approach this with a real compassionate heart and maybe some good questioning, not necessarily having the right answers, I think you can make enormous change in the people around you for whom your voice counts, and I think that's something everybody can do, and I would encourage you all to embrace your power.
All right. Jennifer.
Thank you to everybody at the table. It's been great. And I want to just piggyback off of what Taylor and Maxwell just said and say that if you want to be – people often get hung up because they feel like they have to get themselves perfect before they can intervene in society, and it doesn't work that way. None of us are going to be perfect. I've been doing this work, I don't know, like I said, at least 28 years, almost 30 years, and I still sometimes get it wrong. And I'm blessed that people will tell me I got it wrong and put that energy into helping me get better. But so don't, if you're sitting out there going, but I'm too messed up to be doing this, I don't know enough yet. It's okay. You're never going to feel like you know enough. You're never going to feel like you're perfect. We actually get better through the action of doing it. So go, you know, step up even if you don't feel like you're going to do it perfectly.
I really want to thank everyone with just a really full heart for taking on this topic, which is big, and making it meaningful and understandable. I also want to thank Jean La Pietra and I.D. Hopkins,
fantastic,
too, for coming in and sharing their perspective.
And if you missed that, by the way, it's at khum.com. Strongly suggest people listen to that. It was an amazing conversation, and I.D. really shared some stuff.
And I also wonder, on November 21st, we're having a healing breakfast at the Eureka Women's Club.
Yes, we are.
From 8 to 10. And I wonder if any of the football players would be able to join us. That would be so cool.
There's free pastries.
More pastries.
That's all you got to say. Yeah.
Pastries, coffee.
They're already lining up at the door.
Music. Yeah, and music. And just it's just an inspiring environment, and it would be wonderful. And it makes me really happy that we have made a lot of progress where we bring all different kinds of people to the table, and we're all in this together.
All righty. And I guess my final comment would be that change happens one person at a time, and you, if you're listening, you are one person, and you can change, and you can affect change, and you can say something when you know you should.
And you can go to the website for help with resources if you need help or you want help or you know someone who needs help.
Yeah, there's a terrific interactive guide at the KHUM, at the Stop the Violence website, which is on the main website of KHUM.com. Just click on the Stop the Violence logo, and it'll take you to a schedule of all the stuff we're doing this year. It's got an archive of all the interviews that we've done, and, of course, that interactive guide. And there's also now a guide in Spanish as well. We began, indeed. Next week, we are going to be dealing with the topic of sexualized violence in Humboldt County. It is a topic we've dealt with many times. We've touched on it this week. It is still a major thing that needs to be dealt with, and unfortunately there has been a lot of high-profile cases that have really, once again, brought it to the forefront. So that is going to be the overarching topic next week, and my first guest on Tuesday the 11th is going to be Paula Arrowsmith-Jones from the North Coast Rape Crisis Team. Always a fantastic guest having her here, and Paula, we say, please drive safely. Alrighty, you've got it on KHUM, and if you missed any of the interviews, again, they're at khum.com. Just click on the Stop the Violence page.